In the book of Matthew, chapter 5, is a series of almost proverbs that Jesus spoke that are often referred to as the Beatitudes. And I want to read from Matthew chapter 4, beginning at verse 25, and we'll read through verse 12 of chapter 5. So it's a fairly lengthy reading, and if you care to follow along, that might be beneficial. Beginning at verse 25, Matthew 4, "And there followed him great multitudes of people from Galilee, and from Decapolis, and from Jerusalem, and from Judea, and from beyond Jordan. And seeing the multitudes, he went up into a mountain, and when he was set, his disciples came unto him. And he opened his mouth and taught them, saying, Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you, and persecute you, and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake, rejoice and be exceeding glad, for great is your reward in heaven, for so persecuted they the prophets which were before you." Today I want to study some of these Beatitudes with you, and I choose to call this lesson the beginning of faith. In Hebrews 11 and verse 6, the apostle said, "But without faith it is impossible to please him, for he that cometh to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who diligently seek him." So we know that it is impossible to please God unless we have faith. Faith, as defined by the apostle in that particular place, is conviction and confidence. Conviction, that first of all, that God exists, and secondly, confidence that God will do exactly that which he promised. There is one thing that we can know about God, and that is that the one thing he cannot do is lie. And so when he promises something, we may be absolutely certain that he will do exactly as he said. The text now before us, and the one read in your hearing, describes the experience of a person who turns from darkness to light. And it marks the beginning of that life, which if consistently pursued, will ultimately lead to a home with God. Sometimes people say that the Beatitudes is really a study in values, and I suppose that's probably true. And that Jesus is really saying, in effect, if you want to be happy, if you want to be blessed, and some of you know that sometimes you'll see in translations, instead of blessed are they, as people read happy are they, and so that's entirely possible that Jesus is saying, if you want to be happy, if you want to be blessed, here is the recipe. Here is the standard of values, if you please. And in verse 3, Jesus begins by saying, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." You know, this used to puzzle me. And I used to feel like it was hard for me to get my mind wrapped around what it would be like to be poor in spirit. Because from my perspective, it seemed to me that to make God happy and to please God, we need to be wealthy in spirit. We need to be rich in spirit. And yet Jesus here says, "Blessed are the poor in spirit." Well, I got to thinking about that. What does it mean to be poor, period? Well, some of us have known what it's like to be poor physically. It means that we are without resources. We are without money. We may be even without a place to live, as Jesus was when he lived here on this earth. You know, he said to the fellow who wanted to follow him one time, he said, "The foxes have holes and the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man hath not where to lay his head." So Jesus knew what it was like to be poor physically. Well, if that's what it takes to be poor physically, then obviously to be poor spiritually is to be without spiritual resources. We don't have anything spiritually to be wealthy in. We feel keenly our lack of resources in that respect. So that's what it means to be poor in spirit. And apparently, when a fellow realizes that he is poor in spirit, he is then willing to listen to the Lord, listen to his terms, and accept help on the Lord's terms. This seems, I think, to be the idea that Jesus is putting out. Now, worldly men sometimes say, and we've all heard this many times, that in order to be successful in this world, we need a bit of pride and perhaps even a little arrogance, they say, in order to be successful in this world, because if you don't think well of yourself, then others are not likely to think well of you either. Well, in some respects, that's right. For instance, in whatever work you are involved in, whether it be sales or some sort of a trade, whatever it may be, if you don't have pride, so to speak, in what you do, it is not likely that you're going to excel and be the best in your field, or at least in that area. So it's fine to have pride in your work. And by the way, I was reading some historical writings some time ago, and you know, it is believed, and I can't prove this, but I'll pass it on to you for whatever it's worth. You know, Joseph, the supposed father of Jesus, was a carpenter. And Jesus is spoken of as the carpenter's son. You know, it's said, and it's widely believed among some scholars, that Joseph and Jesus were known to be some of the most skilled craftsmen in that part of the area. Is that true? Well, it makes sense to me that it would have been. I can't imagine Jesus doing anything that he wouldn't have been the very best in. And so it's nice to think of that. You know, in the trade that I have been involved in for 50 years, I have always loved that trade and always tried to do the very best work that I possibly could. And I always watched others who were older than me and had more experience than me to see if I could pick up some of their little tricks and some of their little skills and just kind of add that to my repertoire, so to speak. And so, you know, from that standpoint, yeah, it's fine to have pride. But you know, the type of pride that is spoken of in the Bible, that's not spoken of well. That's not spoken of in a complimentary fashion. In fact, Solomon wrote in Proverbs 16 and 18 and said, pride goeth before destruction and a haughty spirit before a fall. You know, I don't care who you are. Nobody likes to be around somebody that's a prideful man. And someone with a haughty spirit. You know, people like that just make us tired. We just don't enjoy being in that kind of company because maybe it's because they make us feel inferior, but I think there's just something about them that just kind of grinds on you a little bit. And so pride in that respect is something that we're not supposed to be. We're not supposed to act that way. We're not supposed to be the kind of people that make others nervous because we think of ourselves as being so good and being so worthy. Well, obviously not. God's people are always supposed to be poor in spirit from that standpoint. In 1 Peter 5 and verse 6, Peter said, humble yourselves, therefore, under the mighty hand of God, that he may exalt you in due time. The old preachers used to have a saying that the way up is down, the way down is up. And what they meant by that was, if you want to be important, if you want to be a big man in God's sight, then what you need to do is humble yourself. Put yourself down where you need to be, and then you will become somebody that the Lord can exalt and make something out of you. You remember when Samuel anointed Saul to be king. Saul was a great big fella. He was taller than, the Bible says he was head and shoulders taller than his fellows. And so he was just one of those great big fellows that everybody saw everywhere he went. But you know, Saul was such a timid person, and believe it or not, he was small or little in his own sight. He was very timid. He was very humble. He didn't consider himself worthy of great things. And so when it came time for Samuel to anoint him king, they couldn't find him. You know where he was? The Bible says he had hidden himself among the stuff, or among the baggage, as scholars like to put it. And so he felt so, he just didn't feel up to that. He felt so small and so inadequate that he went and hid so that hopefully they might pass him by. Well, he became a great king as long as he was little in his own sight. But you remember what happened when he was supposed to go down and destroy the Amalekites. You know that story. I won't bother to tell it in its entirety. But the long and the short of it was, he didn't do what God told him to do through Samuel. He was supposed to tell everybody down there, but he didn't. He brought the king back. He was supposed to destroy all of the animals, but he didn't. He brought the best of the fatlings of the oxen back. And when Samuel saw him, and the first thing he said to Samuel was, "Blessed be thou of the Lord, I have performed the commandments of the Lord." He hadn't done any such thing. And Samuel said, "What meaneth then the lowing of the oxen and the bleating of the sheep in my ears?" He just pretty well showed him up for what he was. He was a fraud. He was not doing what he was said to, what he'd been told to do. And Samuel told Saul, "When thou wast little in thine own sight," he began to tell what God had done for him. You've done this and you've done that, and God made this, that, and the other out of you, but it was when you were little in your own sight. I want to tell you something. There's a great lesson for us there. Little in your own sight. Don't ever allow yourself, none of us should ever allow ourselves to be big in our own sight and important in our own sight. Because I'm going to tell you something. In Isaiah 66, 1 and 2, it's a passage that will just bring you right back down. Listen to this. "Thus saith the Lord, the heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool. Where is the house that you build unto me? And where is the place of my rest? For all those things hath mine hand made, and all those things have been, saith the Lord." Now I want you to think about what God said through Isaiah. And this is 700 years or so before Jesus ever came into the world. The Lord says, "The heaven is my throne, and the earth is my footstool." You look around at the earth and you see all the things that men have done. You say, suppose you could say to yourself, "I have done this," and there were some Bible characters that had that kind of an attitude. Well, that's this earth, if we did everything in it, that's where the Lord puts his feet. The earth is my footstool. And the heavens, my, just think how far you can see with modern telescopes. And when they get a telescope that'll see further, you know what they find? They just find more and more and more that they didn't even know was there. And there are planets out yonder that are so huge that it just beggars description. And they're so far that it literally takes perhaps hundreds or even thousands of light years for light to reach here from there. And that's the Lord's throne. And we're supposed to think that we can somehow make an impact on God by the great things that we have done when he spoke all of that into existence with a word? Well, of course not. As Linwood used to say, we are literally like Ned in the first reader when we think that we are going to do something big like that. And when we compare ourselves to the God that we serve, we are literally nothing. And that in itself ought to keep us where we ought to be. So, the Lord said, "For all those things hath mine hand made, and all those things have been, saith the Lord." Listen. "But to this man will I look, even to him that is poor, and of a contrite spirit, and trembleth at my word." You know what a contrite spirit is? The dictionary tells us that it is a feeling of deep sorrow or remorse for having made a mistake. That's what we are when we feel contrite. We're penitent. We're sorry for the wrong things that we have done. Well, God help us to be that kind of people. We're not going to impress God with our greatness. If we impress God, we're going to do it because we are poor of spirit and realize how much we need the God of heaven. And then he said in verse 4, "Blessed are they that mourn." There's another one that was difficult for me to wrap my mind around. Blessed are they that mourn. Why was it so great, I used to think, for somebody to be sad, for someone to be mourning? That was hard for me to get hold of. Then I began to think about it. This beatitude, this saying, has a relationship, really, to the first one. This relationship, I think, is forcefully illustrated by the case of the prodigal son. It's amazing how many stories, how many lessons you can learn from the saying to Jesus. Because the prodigal son gives you, first of all, an example of sin, and then a feeling of misery, and finally a confession of sin, and eventually a reinstatement to former position. That's what that story is all about. You remember the story, so I won't belabor the point, but Jesus gave the parable. He spoke in parables many times, and he said a certain man had two sons, and the younger of the sons came to the father and said, "Father, give me that portion of goods which falleth to me." And this father was analogous, if you will, to the Father in heaven. And this younger son didn't have any right to ask what he did. Absolutely not. Ordinarily, in that society, the older brother would have inherited first, and then the younger. But this time, the younger boy, impetuously, impulsively, comes to the father, "Father, let me have what's mine. I want it now." And the father divided his living between the boys. Jesus said not many days hence, the young man took his leave and went into a far country. Obviously, a country full of Gentiles. Because this young man at first lived the life of, well, he lived the high life, as we say. He had plenty, and he had his money. He was absolutely flying high, as we say. But it wasn't long, you know, when you're not having anything come in, it doesn't take very long to blow what you've got to put up. And so after a while, all the fun times and all the parties were over, and he was as broke as he could be. And he joined himself to a citizen of the country. A Gentile? Almost certainly he was. And this Gentile man sent this Jewish boy, get that now, into his fields to feed swine. Now to a Jew, there was nothing any more unclean than a pig. They were unclean. They couldn't eat them. They were nasty. People used them, you know, to clean up the garbage in the streets. They, you know, the Jews had to eat those things that chewed the cud and parted the hoof. And the hog parts the hoof, but he doesn't chew the cud. He might chew about everything else, but he doesn't chew the cud. And so this young man is feeding swine. Some of you have done that. I have fed pigs. Have no shame whatsoever about it, but I'm not going to lie to you and tell you that it was something I really enjoyed. It was just something I had to do. But you know, this young man became so hungry, he was so without physically, that he was ready to eat with the pigs. And you know, Jesus said something there that I missed for the longest time. Jesus said he would fain have filled his belly with the husk that fell from the hogs, and no man gave unto him. Nobody wanted him around. You know, there's an old song that the blues singers used to sing, and it was called, "Nobody Wants You When You're Down and Out." And how true that is. And when this young man got so far down that he didn't have anything to eat, he obviously would not have been very clean. He was down there feeding the hogs. Nobody gave him anything. But Jesus said he came to himself. That's the key. And he said, "This is what I'm going to do." He said, "You know, my father's got servants. Now, they're only servants, but they have bread and to spare. Here I am a son, and I don't have anything, and nobody will give me anything." He said, "I'm going to go home. I'm going to get up, and I'm going to go home, and I'm going to say to my father, I have sinned, get this now, I have sinned against heaven and before thee, and am no more worthy to be called thy son. Just make me as a hired servant." And that's what he did, and you remember the rest of the story. He went home, and there was a joyous reunion. And I want to tell you something. When you have somebody that's been away from the Lord and finally comes to himself, when he goes home, when he comes back to the church, and then says, Lord, just make me as you will. Then you've got somebody that the Lord can do something with. There is somebody that can amount to something. It's not what I want to be, but what can the Lord make out of me? There's the difference. And so this is why Jesus is saying here, blessed are they that mourn. You say, how's that got anything to do with the prodigal son? Simply this. The young man went off into sin, made some terrible mistakes, became loathful even in his own sight, and felt so sorry for the terrible things he had done, and went home and begged his father's forgiveness. Now, when somebody is truly contrite, see how it does tie in with the attitude? When someone is truly sorry for what he has done or she has done, then you have a possibility of great things that can come about. They mourn because of life's misfortune, the loss of life, the loss of their health, the loss of their fortune, and maybe more importantly, they are brought to see life in its proper perspective and are able to set their own course aright. I want to read you just a few words from what Solomon said in Ecclesiastes 7. He said, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. Seems strange, doesn't it? For that is the end of all men, and the living will lay it to his heart. What are you saying, Solomon? He says it's better to go to the house of mourning where people are sad because somebody's dead than it is to go to a party, the house of feasting. Why? Because when you go to the house of mourning where people are sad over the loss of life, maybe for the first time you realize this is where life comes to. This is the end of it all. And this is the way I'm going to be. And Solomon said, the living will lay it to his heart. In other words, they'll consider that. There's a lesson to be learned there. He said, sorrow is better than laughter, for by the sadness of the countenance, the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Where's the wise man? Where's his heart? In the house of mourning. But where is the heart of the fool? In the party. In the great times. In the good times. Because they don't think anything about what's going to be later. But you know, that always comes. It always comes to be later. You know, I don't know where my life has gone. I really don't. It's not going to be very long. This fall, I will be 70 years old. And I still think of myself as being a young man and even a young preacher. Obviously, I'm not. But I still think of myself that way. I still feel good. But I realize when I see all of my friends, and especially when I look in the mirror in the morning and see the way I look, and I sometimes say to myself, who is that old man? Some of you are nodding. You see the same thing. We're changing. We're getting older. And we need to remember that one of these days, we will be the cause of the mourning in somebody's house. Now there's a lesson for you to think about. Blessed are they that mourn. And then again, in verse 5, he said, blessed are the meek. Now the relation of this with the first two Beatitudes may also be illustrated by the case of the prodigal son. Luke 15, 17-19. Sin, misery, confession, God's forgiveness, and finally, a restoration in the sight of God. The basic idea seems to be one of gentleness in the sense that Jesus was gentle. You know, Isaiah said in Isaiah 42 and verse 3, speaking of Christ in those messianic prophecies that he uttered, he said, the bruised reed will he not break. There again is a strange one. If you've ever enjoyed being out in the wild, as I still do, along the creeks and the rivers, maybe by a lake, there will be some reeds grow up. They may grow up pretty tall sometimes. And they're pretty strong, and they feel pretty stiff. But you know, if you just take a little stick or something and just tap one on the side, there'll be a little dark spot show up on that leaf. That's a bruise. And the first time that the wind comes from the opposite direction of the bruise, it'll just topple over. Now the idea that Jesus is gentle is born of this, and Isaiah undoubtedly has seen that. A bruised reed will he not break. How gentle was he? Well, you just look at the way that Jesus led the disciples. He led them gradually. He led them patiently to a more complete and full knowledge of God. He was gentle, and he was truthful. And yet, when he pointed out sin, he didn't always show it in a spirit of gentleness. You remember when he threw the money changers out? He was unhappy then. He said, "My Father's house is supposed to be a house of prayer. You've turned it into a den of thieves." And he threw them out. But you know, I think one of my favorite cases, maybe my favorite example and incident of the life of Christ, is found in the 8th chapter of the book of John, beginning at verse 1. Jesus had come from, I wish I had the time to tell you some of the background of this, because there were people after him. They wanted to arrest him and bring him in and kill him. In fact, there were some officers of the court that had called for his being arrested. They sent some chief priests and Pharisees after him. They went up there to get him, I suppose. But they never heard anybody talk like him. And when they came back, the officer said, "Why did you not bring him?" And they said, "No man ever spake like this man." And they said, "Are you fooled too? Has he fooled you? Search the scriptures. No prophet ever came out of Galilee." They showed their ignorance there. Did you know that Jonah the prophet, who was a type of Christ, came from about 3.5 miles outside of Nazareth? That's where Jesus came from. So there are two of the greatest men in the Bible that you'll ever read about who did come out of Galilee. These fellows didn't know what they were talking about. Well, Jesus went on into the temple that morning. And while he was beginning to teach the people, here comes some chief priests and some Pharisees, and they brought a woman with them. I got to be careful or I'll go too long on this. This woman, they set her down in the very midst of everybody, just to make a public spectacle out of her, and they said, "Now this woman was taken in adultery." Now let me remind you that under the Old Testament law, adultery or fornication was a sin that was punishable by death. If you could find two or more witnesses who would testify to that sin having been committed, that person, be it a man or a woman, was stoned to death. That's what the law called for in Leviticus 20. The problem was, Deuteronomy 17 says, that the witnesses have to cast the first stone. So you couldn't just come up with a kangaroo case to get somebody killed that you was mad at. Well, I guess you could, but you had to be willing to take part in the killing. You had to throw the first stones. Well, they brought this woman in. They said, "Now this woman was taken in adultery in the very act." Now that tells you something. Now they said, "We know the law says to stone her, but what sayest thou?" Hoping he'd contradict the law. And Jesus stooped down and began to write in the dirt. And they thought they had him. They pressed the issue. They thought they had him on the horns of a dilemma. And Jesus looked up and said, "He that is without sin among you, cast the first stone." There's your witness. If you want to be a witness against this woman, start throwing rocks. That's what the law says. And then he stooped down and began to write in the dust again. I've always wondered what it was he wrote. The Bible doesn't say. Could it be? Could it be? And I don't mind to tell you that I think it's probable that it was. Could it be that he was writing the names of some men who had been with that woman? Did you notice that they didn't bring a man with her? Now, when they caught the woman, and they said they caught her in the very act, what does that tell you? That tells me that they not only caught her, but they saw the man. They got him too. But somehow or another, they didn't bring him in. Was he one of them? Maybe. It was very likely someone at least they knew, or they would have brought him in. And so as Jesus is writing in the dirt, I don't know if they could read what he was writing. I expect they could. But those fellows just began to sidle out of there. Now, there's an interesting thing about the old law. If there were no witnesses that could be found, the case was thrown out. There was no punishment. And so all of these people left, and finally Jesus looked at the woman and he said, "Woman, where are those thine accusers? Doth no man condemn thee?" She said, "No man, Lord." He said, "Neither do I condemn thee. Go and sin no more." That's interesting, isn't it? This fellow would not break the bruised reed. Now, here is a woman that was obviously guilty of a sin worthy of death under the law. But in setting her on the path of right and duty, he was not hateful. He was not mean-spirited. He was gentle. But he set things right. He sure did. And I wouldn't be surprised if this woman did not become a follower of Jesus for the rest of her life. I don't know that. But why wouldn't she be? Why wouldn't she be? Well, then again, in verse 6 he said, "Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled." Have you ever been out somewhere and you were just dying for something to eat or drink? I remember a time that my brother and my brother-in-law and I, out in California many years ago now, we went up way high in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. Cold. Snow on the ground, about 4 feet deep. And real early, about daylight, we walked down about 2 or 3 miles to a stream, and we fished there most of the day. I don't remember if we caught anything, but we fished. When we came out, the sun had come out, and this hard crust that was on the top of the snow had begun to, well, it had softened. And so every step, we went in to about our hips. Now, brother, when you climb a hill, 2 or 3 miles, and every step you go down to your hip, you soon become so tired it is unreasonable to even imagine how tired you are and how thirsty you are. We came on 3 men that were pulling a canoe out. Good-looking canoe, expensive-looking canoe. They said, "Would you fellas like to have a canoe?" They said, and we said, "No, if we got to carry it out of here, we don't want it." And so we left them behind, and I reckon they pulled that canoe out. We never saw them anymore. But just before we got up to the car, my brother-in-law, Clovis Cook, said, "When we get to the car," he said, "I've got each of us a giant-sized Snickers candy bar." Now, I can't eat Snickers anymore since I'm diabetic, but I love those things. And I was so hungry, and I was so thirsty, and I thought, if I can just get that Snickers. That was the greatest thing. In fact, I've never tasted one since that was as good as that one was. Well, now, Jesus is talking about that kind of attitude and that kind of hunger and thirst for righteousness. Why would he say, "Blessed are they that hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled"? I'll tell you why. Because a person who wants the truth that bad won't stop at anything until he gets it. He won't have anything less than the truth. He will leave his family for the truth. He'll cross a continent for the truth. And I personally have seen people who did this. The people in the Philippines are a people who often left their families, left the religion of their fathers in order to obey the truth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Then in verse 7 he said, "Blessed are the merciful." You know, hatred and grudges. Hatred and grudges that are carried do far more damage to the hater than to one who is hated. Let me give you an example. Suppose you get it in for me. Suppose I do something, I may not even be aware of it, but I hurt your feelings somehow. And you learn to hate me, and you are just absolutely consumed with that hatred. Does that bother me? No, I may not even know about it. I may just blithely go on my way. I'm just as happy as I can be, because I don't know anything about it. But you are consumed. You are just torn up with that. What does that tell you? That tells me that if I have a grudge, if I hate somebody, and I don't, but if I did, what do I need to do? Let it go. Let it go. Why? Well, first of all, it's right. Secondly, I'm going to feel better. I'm going to feel better. I'm released from that. And so, Jesus said, blessed are the merciful. Those who are forgiving are relieved of this heavy burden and are thus in a better position to save souls, their own and others. Quickly, blessed are the pure in heart. The heart is the fountain out of which flows the issues of life. Solomon said in Proverbs 4 and 23, keep thy heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. I want to tell you something. We're living in such a wicked time today. I mean, I don't have to tell you that. What you see in books, what you see in magazines, what you read in various stories, what you might see maybe in some kind of a movie, is awful and debauched many times. And if you allow yourself to feast on that, that's what you read, that's what you think about, that's what you see, you know what? You'll soon be just about as debauched as those fellows that you're reading about or those women that you're reading about. I'm telling you, I just never cease to be amazed now at how I see people dress. I mean, I can't even explain how different it is now than it was when I was growing up. I see not only men, but women, dressed in so little. As Brother Gay used to say, it's not enough to ward a shotgun. They just don't wear anything, and they don't care that they flaunt everything, men and women. What's the matter with us? Well, it's the world in which we live. Blessed are the pure in heart. I want to tell you something. It's pretty obvious. The purity of heart is in mighty short supply today. It's in mighty short supply. Beware what you put in your heart. It will have a lasting effect on you. Blessed are the peacemakers. You know, Christians are to be peaceable themselves. Romans 12 and verse 18, Paul said, if it be possible, as much as lies in you, live peaceably with all men. You may not be able to get along with everybody, but try. Do the best you can. And as much as possible within you, get along with them. It seems to me, though, that the idea goes even a little step further. It requires us to try to make or promote peace, if you will, among others. You know, in Colossians 4 and verse 6, Paul said, let your speech, that is literally your discourse in the original language, let your speech be always with grace or graciousness or a kindly attitude, seasoned with salt, which makes it more palatable, easier to accept, that you may know how you ought to answer every man. Not only do I need to try to get along with everybody, but I need to follow those things that make for peace. I need to try to promote peace among those with whom I live. I'm running out of time. I want to skip to the last one. In verse 11, Solomon said, blessed are the reviled. You know, the church has been made a scapegoat for all of the ills of the Roman Empire, was made a scapegoat for all of the Roman ills of the empire, from fires to famines. If you want to really get an idea of what it took to create the brotherhood that we have today, read some good historical works, true historical works. You're going to find historical accounts of the times when the Romans would catch people in a church building like this, maybe a home, maybe some place where they had chosen to meet. They would lock the doors and the windows, set the place afire, and burn it down on top of everybody. Nobody allowed to get out. Everybody killed. Read the historical accounts of women who had their children taken from their arms and within their sight and within their hearing, fed to wild animals. You just imagine that. I don't have to tell you what that would be like. The church has gone through some awful times. And I really don't know of anything that makes me any more tired than to hear sometimes our own people act like or talk like, even in their lessons, that maybe the church is going to be destroyed. It might be here. It might be where I live or where you live. But you know what? I've read the back of the book, and God's people win. When the Lord comes again, there will be his people here. I don't know where. Maybe not even in this country. But there will be his people. And there will be those that he will come to get and take home to glory. Blessed are the reviled. Don't feel badly when somebody speaks evil of you because you're a Christian. That's quite a compliment. That really is. Great blessings are pronounced upon all of those who belong to the Lord. Well, I'm sorry I didn't get all of the Beatitudes, but I think you can see that when Jesus gives a lesson, whether it be a parable or these Beatitudes, there are so many lessons. I mean, they just keep coming from what he said. That seems to be different than what even the other gospel writers did. There's something about the teachings of Christ that just go beyond. I love to read what Paul wrote. But you know, the older I get, the more I am sure that I would rather read the writings and the sayings of Christ than anybody. They're wonderful.